Need a much longer text in introducing the speaker than he does in making the presentation. Yeah, but not only after you've listened carefully and taken notes.
And passed the test.
Well, after the last Alumni Magazine, why Fred Barnes should be introducing me instead of my trying to introduce him. The only trouble is both of us lost copies, if he ever had one, of the Alumni Magazine. But you know, there is a very extensive article about two famous alumni, and he's one of them. He's senior editor of the New Republic. He received his bachelor's degree in history from the University of Virginia in 1965. He went to the Charleston, South Carolina News Courier as a reporter, then returned and did graduate work at George Washington University, and went on to the Washington Star, where he was a writer for 12 years. He joined the Baltimore Sun in 1979 and continued until 1985. And thereafter follows a whole series of activities, some of which you're undoubtedly familiar with, the New Republic and the McLaughlin Show. But he also is the host of a radio show. He tapes a Voice of America program, Issues in the News. He and Mort Kondracki tape every Thursday a debate program for Op-Ed, called Op-Ed for INN television. That program on INN is produced on Saturdays. He's working on a book on the political culture of Washington, how it has changed since the time of JFK, and in his spare time, I'm sure he does many other things, such as write for Reader's Digest 4 times a year, and more recently a column on politics for Vogue magazine. So, following the pattern of inviting one or two journalists and a couple of scholars to discuss with us the Reagan presidency, it seemed very natural, given his writings over the last 8 years or so, that one turned to Fred Barnes to try to learn a little more from his vantage point about the Reagan presidency.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I actually came back to UVA after I graduated in 65, not at all, for about 25 years, and or 20 years, hasn't been 25, about 20 years. But now my daughter goes here, so she's in her second year, and she has a class this afternoon, so she's not here. She's heard all this stuff. So I've come back a lot of times, actually. I've been back a number of times. There are a number of journalists which I would recommend that you might get, and you said you talked to Edmund Morris, the historian who had tremendous access at the Reagan White House in Reagan's second term, who was going to know more about Reagan than any journalist, probably know more about a president than any journalist in the ever. And I'm certainly looking forward to his book. Lou Cannon of the Washington Post knew Reagan for a long time in California and then in Washington. And, of course, the other guy who's a journalist and spent some time working for Reagan is Pat Buchanan, who worked for Reagan for 2 years, got in at the right time and out at the right time. Ken has handed me some questions here, some of which I'm going to touch on, but I had some other things that I was going to talk about, which I think, in talking about them, I'll touch on most of these questions. If not, I'll go back and answer a couple of them. What I thought I'd talk about is the differences, and I've put together 5 of them, between Reagan and Bush, and talk about the Reagan side of these differences. Obviously, you can see Bush every day. You know what he's doing. Reagan, people forget a little bit. It's amazing how quickly people forget, even though it seemed like Reagan was president forever. The first one is this, is that Reagan was a was and is a passive person, but had a very active presidency. And Bush is a very active person, works on 20, 25 things a day, but has a very passive presidency. Reagan had an amazing knack for never knowing more than he needed to. He always knew, he usually knew just enough. Sometimes he was a little short. I remember that probably the worst briefing Reagan ever gave was one on when he announced his decision on the MX missile. And the first question, which was not even technical, this was back about 83, he had to turn over to Cap Weinberger to answer because he just didn't know the details of the missile basing system and so on. But usually Reagan knew just enough to get by and not a whole lot more, which is actually very much like a journalist. Usually you write, if you do your job right, after 20 years I figured out how you can do just enough reporting, that just the amount you need and no more. So you can use your time a lot more wisely that way. And it's also just like an actor. An actor learns just the lines he's going to use and he doesn't learn anymore. I mean, they don't do any extra work. Reagan, of course, got his information from some unusual places for a president. Until the day he left the White House, he always read Human Events every week. Human Events is a conservative weekly newspaper that's put out by some folks in Washington, and Reagan had read it for years and years. And it had, there were different phases of the Reagan presidency when Age tried to stop sending the issue in to him every week, and Reagan would always ask for it and always get it, and it affected policy in a number of ways. The last one where it had a dramatic effect on Reagan was in the whole subject of the pay raise, the federal pay raise for members of Congress, members of the administration, and particularly federal judges. Because there was a piece in, this is just as Reagan left in January 1989, you'll remember he endorsed the pay raise, the 50% pay raise for members of Congress, the one that did not pass, but Reagan endorsed it, and Bush also endorsed it. But the reason Reagan endorsed it was because he had learned through Human Events, whether this is right or wrong, I don't know, I think it's probably wrong, that judges, conservative judges that he had appointed to the federal judiciary would be leaving office in surprisingly large numbers unless the pay were raised. I don't think that's true that would have happened, but in any case, it was an article in Human Events saying that would happen, and as a result, Reagan was strongly in favor of the pay raise and endorsing it. And of course, Reagan had to send the recommendation. He could have sent a recommendation for 10% or a 20% pay raise or no pay raise at all. It was really his call. He'd gotten the recommendation from a commission. Reagan certainly did show that the job was not necessarily a 10 or 12 or 16 hour a day job. Reagan arrived at 9 and usually didn't stay around for lunch and then came back in the afternoon for a while. He was not the hardest working guy I've ever run across in politics or government. Reagan was great when he was out campaigning because he'd do for president in 84 or 80 or 76 for that matter, because he'd do an event in the morning, the main event for television and the main one, and then he might do something in the afternoon, maybe not. Sometimes he'd give a speech in the evening, sometimes not. You could easily skip it. He wouldn't say anything. It'd just be a standard speech. And so it was very leisurely coverage, leisurely campaigning, leisurely coverage, but enough for television and enough for a story in the newspapers every day. Reagan used to say, and he said this a number of times in speeches, that he'd been told that hard work wasn't fatal, but his attitude was, why take a chance? Rolly Evans, the columnist, who's the partner of Bob Novak, writes a column with Bob Novak, tells a story about having lunch with Reagan. It must have been in 1987, and Reagan would have lunch occasionally with journalists. I went to one of them, in the little study by the Oval Office. Well, on the way out, Rolly was kind of chatting with Reagan and looked up at him and said, you know, Mr. President, I've known you for more than 20 years. I first met you in 1966 when you were running for governor of California, and the amazing thing is, as I look at you now, is that you don't look any older now than you did back then. How do you do it? And Reagan really did have a story for every occasion. And so he said to Rolly, and I've heard this from Rolly, this tale, Reagan said, well, let me explain it this way. Let me tell you the story of the two psychiatrists, the old psychiatrist and the young psychiatrist, who had a practice together, and they'd come into their office every day just bubbling with enthusiasm and happy and upbeat and smiling and chipper. And then they'd go into their separate suites and have patients come in and lie on the couch all day and talk about the woes in their lives. And at 6 p.m. they'd come out, and the young guy, the young psychiatrist, would be devastated, wiped out by the day, just frowning, stomach ache, just miserable. And the old psychiatrist would be just as chipper and smiling and upbeat as he was when he went in the morning. So this went on for a while, a number of months. And finally, one day, they come out, same thing, 6 p.m., young psychiatrist, devastated by the day. The old psychiatrist, just as happy and smiling as he was in the morning at 9 a.m. when he went in. So finally, the young psychiatrist stops him and says, you know, this has been going on month after month. He said, I just don't understand it. We do the same thing every day, and I come out and I'm wiped out by hearing patients all day, and you come out after patients have been streaming in and out of your office, and you're as upbeat as ever. How do you do it? And the old psychiatrist paused a minute and said, I never listen. Now remember, this is Reagan's explanation for how he keeps that youthful look. In talking about the point of Reagan being a passive person and an active president, I had thought, at least around the time the end of Reagan's first term, which was clearly superior to the second term in almost every way, that Reagan would be the most important, he would be the big story of the late 20th century in the world, that he would be the most important historical figure. That obviously was before communism began to become completely unhinged in the during Reagan's second term, something that Reagan had a little bit to do with, but obviously not that much to do with. That's obviously eclipsed Reagan historically as the important thing that happened in the late 20th century. But nonetheless, Reagan did do a lot of things that I think when historians look back, and as I think about it right now, are going to be regarded as very, very important. One is, of course, and these are things that Bush, Jimmy Carter certainly would have done, and I rather doubt if George Bush would have done them. The first is the deployment of the Pershing missiles in Europe in 1983, I guess. And Reagan and the Soviets, when the missiles were deployed, the Soviets, of course, immediately moved out, walked out of the arms control talks in Geneva and didn't come back for several years. And most of why the State Department and in Washington and the press were hysterical in Washington, as they often are anyway. But one of the amazing things about Reagan, and one of the traits that is the least commented on that Reagan had, and Charles Krauthammer, who used to be in the New Republic, and I were talking about this just the other day, was an amazing ability Reagan had to just block out the buzz in Washington and in the rest of the world, for that matter. You could have a firestorm going on in Washington, and unless it went on month after month the way Iran-Contra did, but if it were just a brief one, by that I mean a week or two or three, Reagan could just block it out, not pay any attention to it. You know, the Post could be running these hysterical stories every morning about the fate of the world being terrible because the arms control talks have broken down and the Soviets have walked out, and the State Department types would be upset, and Congress would be going crazy, and Democrats would be criticizing him, and the White House press would be clobbering his press secretary every day, and Larry Speaks then, at the briefings, and Reagan would just be blissful and could just block it out completely, which is ordinarily a great trait. Not always, but often a very great trait. And of course, Reagan, I think, was vindicated entirely in blocking it all out over the Russians leaving the arms control talks. He always said, well, they'll come back. And of course they did. The Pershing deployment was tied to the zero option, which he proposed for eliminating medium-range nuclear missiles in Europe, the zero on both sides. The Soviets would eliminate the SS-20s, and we would eliminate the Pershings. Or it was proposed initially, we wouldn't deploy the Pershings. But the proposal, the zero option, was not taken seriously. It was not taken seriously by most people in the administration, certainly nobody in Washington. But Reagan stuck with it for 6 years, and finally it wound up being the INF treaty. The one thing that Reagan disliked more than anything else, I think, were tepid halfway proposals. Reagan liked a proposal where there was a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. He didn't like sweeping proposals, you know, a proposal where zero medium range nuclear missiles, not 100 on each side, but zero. And tied with that, Reagan liked a proposal, liked proposals, one that were sweeping and two that had clear, palpable political appeal. And this one obviously did. We're eliminating nuclear weapons, that's a popular thing, and it's not surprising to me that when Richard Pearl came up with this, that Reagan grabbed at it immediately, because you can trace through the proposals of the Reagan administration, and most of them were, of the major ones, were sweeping and very politically appealing, such as the 1981 tax cut that Reagan proposed, originally 30% cut, then 25%. I'd love to have been at the meeting in California in January of 1980 when Reagan was first briefed on supply-side economics. Was Jack Kemp was there, and Jude Winiski, Art Laffer, and that's about three-fifths of the whole supply-side movement right there, but they were there and briefed Reagan. And Reagan, for years, had been talking about, and I'm sure some of you all had heard his speeches over the years, had been talked about government. He attacked government. Attacked the size of government and attacked government spending. That was basically Reagan's speech. It was an anti-government speech. But it had limited political appeal, because what Reagan was talking about is it was essentially taking something away from people, taking benefits away, shrinking the size of government. It had been basically what Republicans have been arguing about from the New Deal on. We're going to take things away. The government's doing too much, spending too much. We're going to withdraw it. That's what we want to do. And I think Reagan sensed, in fact, I know he sensed, that that had limited political appeal. And his eyes must have widened immediately, because Reagan had such great political instincts, to the possibilities when supply-side economics was described to him. Because with tax cuts, people get something. Reagan had never been that great a tax cutter before the 1980 campaign. His big issue in 1976 was opposition to the Panama Canal Treaty and just attacks on government in general and anti-communism and criticism of Henry Kissinger when he was running in 76 against Gerald Ford for the Republican nomination and didn't win. But in 1980, it was different. He was talking about reducing the size of government, but particularly cutting taxes. People were going to get something. So you had, with the tax cuts, a sweeping proposal that would reduce tax rates ultimately by 25%. That was politically appealing. And I think at some point along the Jude Winiski claims that Reagan immediately, instinctively knew the appeal of reducing marginal tax rates. And Jude has written about this, because Reagan has talked so many times over the years about, at least in the 1980s, about the practice in Hollywood of an actor would do four or five movies and have 3 or 4 months left in the year, but not do any because the rate on that on the later income would be so high. It could be as high, depending on what the rate was back in the 40s, I think it was up in the 90s even. And so he just wouldn't do any more movies because the marginal tax rate would have moved up so high. Some point along the way, Reagan learned another benefit, what he thinks is a benefit of the tax cut, and that is the strategic deficit. Reagan never used that phrase. To my knowledge, David Stockman never used it, though Pat Moynihan, the senator from New York, claims he did. The strategic deficit being a permanent deficit that has one particular effect, and that is to preclude the possibility of new spending programs. It really is, as Phil Graham used to talk about it, you cut taxes to starve the spending. And the strategic deficit still works. And Reagan, while he would never concede that that was a purpose or that was a goal that was achieved that he was happy about, I think he knew perfectly well what was going on. Then there was the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was almost a one-man band, entirely Reagan's doing, except there's a great story that somebody's going to have. Maybe Edmund Morris will have it. Maybe Lou Cannon will have it in his book. about how Reagan came to propose it in March 1983. Edward Teller played a role, and Reagan has great respect for Edward Teller. Bud McFarlane played a role. He was the, deputy national security advisor? I forget. Anyway, he was around at the time. James Watkins, now the energy secretary in the Bush administration, who was then, I believe, the chief of naval operations and perhaps the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, played a role. Richard Pearl didn't play a role. Richard Pearl became the greatest defender in the administration of Star Wars, but didn't play a role. He was out of the country at the time. When the speech was read to Weinberger and Pearl, when they were in Spain, they urged that part be taken out entirely about Star Wars, and of course Reagan left it in. In any case, Reagan proposed it. And again, think of Star Wars, and think of the way Reagan described it, and Reagan really believed in it that way. This was going to make nuclear weapons obsolete. It was, again, it had the double-barreled appeal. It was a sweeping proposal, and it had tremendous political appeal because any poll, if you've ever read polls on the subject, the American people think we ought to be defended against nuclear attack. The American people, by numbers in the 60s and 70s and 80%, don't buy the idea of mutual assured destruction. That's something for the global thinkers to subscribe to, but the average American thinks, these guys have nuclear weapons, we ought to have a defense. And Reagan and SDI appeals to that viewpoint. So it did have the double-barreled quality to it, a sweeping proposal with great political appeal. Still does have a great political appeal, except one thing has happened, and that's that we have less of a threat. There's with Gorbachev and the Soviet Union dismantling itself and so on. Star Wars was also turned out to be, and sometimes these things have a not entirely unintended consequence, like the strategic deficit from the tax cuts. And in this one, it was Star Wars as the greatest bargaining chip ever in the history of arms control, and maybe in the history of bargaining period. In any kind of negotiations, what an incredible bargaining chip. I think it probably more than anything else prodded the Soviets to do almost everything, almost every concession that they proposed, and there have been a lot of them now, in arms control negotiations. But look what happened just this week, where Edward Shevardnadze, the Soviet foreign minister, declared that the Krasnoyarsk radar site was a clear violation of the ABM treaty. That was done, I believe, entirely to get at Star Wars, to get the Soviets fully behind the ABM treaty, to have a strict interpretation of it in a way that would ban serious testing and certainly deployment of Star Wars at a future date. That's exactly what it's designed at. And actually, Shevardnadze undercut a number of Democratic congressmen and Teddy Kennedy and people like that who'd been denying for years that Krasnoyarsk was a violation of the ABM treaty. And Shevardnadze said it was a clear violation of the ABM treaty. But the Soviets are still obsessed with getting rid of the Strategic Defense Initiative, and the reason is pretty obvious. They can't keep up with it. They can't match it. They don't have the computer capability. They don't have... Anyway, they want to get rid of it. So it's a fantastic bargaining chip now and was during Reagan's term. Then you think of Grenada, which the Pentagon didn't want to invade, and Reagan did. The bombings of Libya, the two bombings of Libya, the Pentagon wasn't quite as opposed to those. The capture of the terrorists from the Achille Lauro, who killed Leon, I can't think of his last name, the American who was...
Klinghoffer.
All of those things are interventionist moves that Reagan liked and things he could decide just like that. Didn't have any qualms about them at all. And compare them with Bush and Panama. You know, where Secretary of State Baker says, gee, there were such rapidly changing events and so on. Well, as they usually are in coups, that they really couldn't do anything. Reagan just always wanted to go ahead. And in those three cases, it turned out pretty well. In Lebanon, when he deployed troops, didn't turn out so well. And then the one thing about Reagan that I think was widely believed was that Reagan would not know when, if a hardline anti-Soviet policy worked, that Reagan wouldn't know when to say, hey, that's worked, now's the time to make concessions, to embrace the Soviets, embrace Gorbachev, and so on. But he did. He did know when the right time was. In other words, the theory behind the hardline foreign policy toward the Soviet Union is that's the way to get them to make concessions, and ultimately we'll reach some agreement, and we won't have a war. And Reagan realized that. He did. Reagan embraced Gorbachev at exactly the point when he didn't have to. He'd been reelected in 1984 overwhelmingly. He wasn't going to run for another term. He was very, very popular. He basically won the argument about whether he had to go back to the bargaining table with the Soviets. Most polls show that the American people think you ought to bargain, but Reagan wasn't doing it, hadn't done it for 2 years, and he'd gotten away with it. So at that point, he embraces Gorbachev, the Geneva summit in November of 1985, and he liked Gorbachev and went on from there with later summits in Washington and Reykjavik and Moscow and so on, which were basically the highlight of his and the only good things that happened, except for tax reform, in his second term. Reagan's second term was a downer for a number of reasons, I think. One is that Reagan got old. Reagan would have good days and bad days. You saw him in June of 1988 when he went to the summit in Moscow. I happened to go and cover that. Reagan was in great shape. But there'd be whole days and weeks, even in his second term in the last couple of years, where he'd be kind of down in the dumps and a little out of it, and not, and seemingly already have had his mind moved to California, where he was going to go after he got out. He would sort of go in and out. But the one thing that I know gave Reagan pleasure in his second term were all these Soviet stories that he would collect. One of the things, I'm sure Edmund Morris would know this, where Reagan got all these Soviet jokes. And Reagan claimed that there are all these stories, ones, and I probably heard 10 or 15 of them from Reagan at one time or another, in speeches and other things. These stories that Reagan claimed were tales that the Russian people would tell each other. Very cynical about life in the Soviet Union, which after all is pretty crummy. And Reagan said, these are really what the Soviet people are telling each other, and then he'd repeat them. My favorite one is the one that Reagan would tell about the Soviet citizen and the American citizen having a debate in Moscow over whose country had the most democracy. And the American says, well, this is ridiculous. Why should we debate this? I mean, everybody knows America has more democracy than the Soviet Union. We elect our leaders. If we don't like them, we vote them out of office. The Soviet Union is a totalitarian dictatorship. He said, in Washington, you know, I can go over to the White House, walk into the Oval Office, go right up to the President's desk and say, President Reagan, you're doing a lousy job. Well, to the surprise of the American, the Russian was not taken aback by this at all, and his response was, well, gee, we have that much democracy here in the Soviet Union. He said, here in Moscow, I can go over to the Kremlin, march right up to the General Secretary's office, go right up to his desk and say, President Reagan's doing a lousy job. Reagan also used to tell the one about the guy who'd been in a bread line in the Soviet Union. And they have, look, I saw him when I was there, a block from the nice hotel where they had the American reporters staying, a long line outside some place that looked like a rundown 7-Eleven. And anyway, this was about a guy who had been standing in a food line for more than an hour, and he just got furious and steaming and finally storms off of there and says, I've had enough, I can't stand this anymore, I'm going to go shoot Gorbachev. And so he goes off and he's gone for about an hour and finally kind of slumps back. And the people said, What happened? Did you shoot Gorbachev? And he said, no, I went over to the Kremlin and the line's even longer over there. Well, Reagan has about 10 or 15 of those. And I'd love to know exactly where he got all his jokes, but particularly those, because he had a lot of them. And he swore they were these were the real thing, that which I doubt, but that's what he said. So the first difference I'm suggesting is that Reagan, while a passive person, certainly passive in his friendships, Reagan, if you ever talk to people, I don't know whether anybody has gone into this in any of your discussions, but Reagan would be extremely close to aides working for him, and when they'd leave, the day they'd leave, they'd never hear from him again. Reagan, I think, is a guy like a number of political figures in Washington who has no friends in the sense that most men or women have close friends. Nancy has a lot of friends. All their friends in Hollywood are Nancy's friends, the people they socialize with. They're not. Ronald Reagan has political associates and political underlings and world leaders that he's a peer with, but doesn't have any friends. Doesn't have people he can just call on and chat with and so on. Bush has too many friends. But Reagan, I can't think of anybody, including his brother, Moon, who is a close friend. And there's certainly nobody that Reagan really opens up to except for Nancy. I mean, Nancy's certainly a very close friend.
You know Edmund Morris's explanation mm-hmm. of that, do you?
No.
That really stems from the movie background
mm-hmm.
because Reagan was, and any principal actor is very mm-hmm. close
yeah.
to the people
mm-hmm.
with whom he's working on a given movie,
right.
but then the movie is all over and then he goes to another movie
yeah.
and he repeats
yeah.
the thing there.
Yeah, others others have cited that as well. It may be Gary Wills in his book, I forget the name of it, I thought it was a terrible book, had a lot of errors in it, but his book about Reagan, very interesting book, but a wrong-headed book in many cases. But I think that there's probably something to that that theory about Reagan. Well, in any case, he's a very passive person but had a very active presidency. My second difference is, and this one is fairly obvious, is that Reagan was confrontational with Congress, with his political opponents, and loved it. And Bush is a compromiser. Reagan didn't like to have personal clashes with people. You know, he loved to get along with Tip O'Neill when they'd come in and chat, but he loved to fight Democrats in general in Congress and fight liberals and fight the communists and all these things. He loved it. He really loved confrontation. Bush hates confrontation. Bush would rather compromise on anything. Bush's idea is to compromise first. Reagan's idea was to compromise at the last possible moment. And Reagan was a lot more effective as a result. Think of what Reagan would be doing today in the situation of the capital gains cut that Bush is supposedly fighting for. A cut that he talked about in the election and won the election. I don't think you could construe that as a mandate for a capital gains cut, but at least it was tossed out and the public voted for him. And secondly, has been overwhelmingly voted for in favor of in the House of Representatives, and Democrats will acknowledge that there are more than 50 senators who are in favor of it. If you could just have a vote, a clean vote on it, rather than one where you needed 60 votes to procedurally attach it to some other bill. And Bush sort of whines about why don't they let a vote, why don't they let this thing go through, or why don't they put it on the reconciliation bill. But Reagan would be, he'd be on national television, he'd be steaming, he'd be describing this in some colorful term about how many dollars are being, you know, to Mars are being denied the American people because this capital gains cut hasn't gone through. Think of the Contras and how many times Reagan confronted Congress on the subject of the Contras in Nicaragua. Bush avoided it from the beginning. If you could just run down a list of things. Reagan was extremely, extremely confrontational and enjoyed it very much. Another obvious difference is that Reagan was a very ideological person. Some people have tried to describe him as really a closet pragmatist. I don't think Reagan was at all. I think he was easily the most ideological president since I've been covering things in Washington, but that only goes back to Lyndon Johnson. But from reading, I think the most ideological president perhaps ever. Reagan was just a very strong ideological person. I mean, he had an agenda. It was a short agenda, but there were things on there that he cared deeply about. Reducing taxes, cutting the size of government, building up the military, and having an assertive anti-communist American foreign policy. He didn't reduce the size of government, but he did do some make some headway on the other three. And that's exactly what Reagan really cared about. Reagan was not the most, and isn't still, the most widely read guy in the world, but he'd been affected deeply by some of the things that he'd read. Particularly one of the things that always comes to my mind is Witness, the book by Whitaker Chambers. And Reagan had read it a number of times, and Tony Dolan, I don't know whether you've had him in or not, the White House speechwriter, chief speechwriter for 8 years at the White House, or not for eight, but he was a speechwriter for eight, and chief speechwriter for some of it, tells a story about going in and talking to Reagan. They're working on a speech, which was the Evil Empire speech, actually, which was originally written for Reagan to deliver in London in 1982 or 3, when he spoke to Parliament in London, and that was the Evil Empire speech, which they thought better of, and Reagan didn't deliver it then, so he delivered it later to that evangelical gathering in Orlando. I guess it was 82 or 83, I forget the date. But in any case, Tony Dolan is another fan of Witness by Whitaker Chambers, which I agree is a great book. I've tried to get my wife and children to read it, but they won't do it. In any case, he goes in and they're talking about Witness, and the first part of the book is about Whitaker Chambers is talking about his daughter's earlobe, and Tony Dolan starts to recite some of it, and Reagan just picks it up in mid-sentence and can recite part of this opening, this introduction to Witness. He remembered the book very well. That's why Whitaker Chambers got a posthumous Medal of Freedom, which his son came and accepted. But if you read Witness, you'll see that there's a phrase in there, something about communism being, and the Soviet Union being, the focus of evil in the world. And that phrase is used in the Evil Empire speech, and Reagan goes on to use the phrase evil empire. But there are things back in the 50s, Reagan used to read some conservative economists, which affected him deeply. His whole flirtation with, as the head of the Screen Actors Guild, with communists in Hollywood affected him deeply. Reading Witness affected him, and he became an extraordinarily fervent anti-communist. And I think the thing that really allowed him to truly move toward a détente with the Soviet Union was the fact that he liked Gorbachev. He liked him a lot, and they really did hit it off. Nancy Reagan claims in her book, which I haven't read all of yet, I've read the Newsweek excerpt, I have to read it this weekend because I have to review it, but she claims in her book that it was her idea entirely to have the fireside chat, you know, down by the lake. They went down to that little house, and there was the boathouse or something down by the lake in Geneva, the November 1985 summit. It was her idea to have the two get together for a chat, and they were supposed to chat for half an hour, and they wound up chatting for 90 minutes or something like that. That's partially true. What actually happened was Bill Henkel, the chief advance man, when they got over to Geneva a day or two early, pleaded with him and said, you know, we need to do a run-through, because he believed, Henkel, a very talented guy who was the brains behind Mike Deaver, believed that Reagan, being an actor, it was always better to take him through his paces, you know, have a rehearsal, basically, choreograph it a little bit, have him know what the stage is going to be wherever he was. You know, what's this place going to look like? And what's the room like where you can actually negotiate? Nancy didn't want to do it. Henkel was given a hearing with Nancy. I just talked to him last week. That's how this is fresh in my mind, with Henkel, who now works for Merrill Lynch up in New Jersey. Nancy was adamant about not doing it, and Henkel was called up to make a last-minute plea to Nancy, who was in bed at the time, lying on a bed at the time, never got up, as he pleads with her over and over again to say, Mrs. Reagan, you know, we have to do this. It's important to do it. They'd gotten there a couple days early. It's so important to do this. This, the whole outcome of these talks can depend on this. And finally, he begged her, and she said, okay, fine. And so they went around, and they went down to the boathouse, and then Nancy said, you know, maybe they could have a chat here. But that's the only way it happened, after she had refused for several days to even go around and look at this place ahead of time. Otherwise, that fireside chat wouldn't have happened. I give her only half credit. Henkel deserves a lot of credit. Well, in any case, we know Bush is a pragmatist. He's not an ideological president. Bill Schneider of the American Enterprise Institute refers to him as an in-basket president, which I think is about right, you know, whichever in the in basket when he gets in the morning, and somebody else has put it there, that's what he deal with. Reagan filled his own in basket. Fourthly, Reagan was a great wholesale politician, and Bush is your classic retail politician. For Reagan, the performance was the most important single thing. His performance in public was the most important thing. He preferred to be appealing to a national audience on television, but not always. I mean, it was important for him to do well in every speech. Jim Lake was Reagan's press secretary in the 1976 campaign, and then for half of the 1980 campaign until he got fired in February of 1980. But Jim Lake tells the story of being with Reagan in 1976, and they're flying into Tennessee for a speech where Reagan's going to give a speech. It's fairly late in the campaign for the Republican nomination, and they're about 20, 25 minutes from landing. And Lake, they're going to put out a press release or something, so Lake goes into Reagan's compartment and wants to raise some issue with him. And he said, Jim told me later this was the only time that Reagan ever got mad at him. He just got all flustered and said, no, I'm busy, can't you see him working on my speech? I have to work on this, and you know, just go away. I have to work on, we're going to be there in 20 minutes and I have to give this speech and so on. And Reagan was madly working away, getting his speech just right. Well, the thing is, this is the same speech that Reagan had given 1,000 times before, but yet the performance was what mattered, and he went over his speech over and over again, and to get a little nuance that would be appropriate for Tennessee, and he worked on it every time, worked on his speech, because the performance mattered. Now, I say there's a new guy in the White House who is the new Mike Deaver, and his name, maybe you've read the New York Times did a story about him the other day. His name is Sig Rogich. He's from Las Vegas, and he's a media consultant, a Republican media consultant, makes TV ads for campaigns. And he's a believer in something that he calls moments. And he wants to create some moments for George Bush. You know, these sort of epiphanies on television where it will just capture something, some moment that will be seared in the mind of the American people in a very appealing way. Reagan didn't need a guy to tell him about moments, because Reagan created some extraordinary moments, I think, because I can remember, I don't remember where I was, although I was at UVA at the time, where I was when John Kennedy was shot, but I remember exactly where I was during, and I thought of three of them this morning when I was jotting down some notes, of moments that Reagan had. And the first one was on June 4th, 1984, when Reagan gave his speech at Normandy, the D-Day speech. And I was staying at the Chateau Marmont Hotel in Los Angeles, the one where John Belushi was killed. The California primary was coming up, and I watched the speech early in the morning on television, because Reagan was obviously 9 hours away or 8 hours away or something, maybe 7 hours. And Reagan gives this speech with these survivors, American soldiers who had actually landed at Normandy there, and talks about this this one guy whose daughter was there, and it was just the most extraordinary speech I've ever heard. No news content whatsoever. He didn't advance any policy or anything, just extraordinary. And it became the bulk of the 18-minute film about Reagan that was shown at the Republican National Convention. Easily the most powerful piece of political propaganda I have ever seen, about this 18-minute film, of this big flap over whether the network should show it or not. I think they should have showed it. They didn't, but they should have. I mean, it was great publicity for Reagan, but it was just a fantastic piece of political propaganda. Unbelievable. And it really concentrated on this speech and this particularly the part where he talks about this one guy whose daughter was there, and how, I forget exactly what it was, she promised him that she would go back there or something, and she was there in regular speech. Oh, it's unbelievable. That's one of them. The second one is Reagan and the families of the Challenger victims. Remember when the Challenger exploded in 86? And Reagan, I think, the families assembled in Houston, as I recall, and Reagan and Mrs. Reagan went down there. Reagan was always fantastic. He could just, he could do events like that like nobody ever could. People denigrated it by saying he was a great ceremonial president. It was a lot more than just being a ceremonial president. It was capturing the right emotion. It was his ability to deal with people. And I can remember sitting on my couch at home and watching a replay of this whole thing on C-SPAN on television, and I just had to turn it off. It was just so emotional. Reagan gave a speech that was written by Peggy Noonan, and she was very good at writing these emotional speeches, but it was just powerful the way Reagan acted there. And the last one I thought of was one day, I always go, the events I always like at the White House, the inconsequential public events, are the ones they do with athletic champions. You know, the World Series winner, or the Super Bowl champs, or the NBA champs. I always go to those. They're fun to go to, particularly if you're a sports fan, and I am, you can go and, you know, mingle with these guys. But Reagan was tremendous with these teams, the utterly inconsequential ceremonial events. But I remember the one when the Los Angeles Lakers came. And they presented Reagan, you know, with a jersey with number one and Reagan on the back and a basketball. And Reagan, while everybody was still standing there, this is in the Rose Garden, and Reagan's over here with the Lakers behind him and all the press is over here, and then there are all the assembled friends and, you know, wives of the Lakers and so on over here. The White House is over here, the Oval Office. Actually, the White House is over here, but the Oval Office is over here. And Reagan alone walks across the grass toward the Oval Office. And he's got this basketball. He's kind of throwing it up in his hands, this basketball. And he kind of looks over out the side of his eye, out the side of his head, looks over at the cameras over there, and dribbles it once on the grass. If you ever dribbled a basketball on the grass, you know, but the ground is lumpy. The ball is just as likely to bounce away somewhere. But with Reagan, it bounced right back in his head. I always thought if it was Jimmy Carter, the ball, he'd have dribbled it off his foot. Because he was terrible at those events. The ball bounced right up, and Reagan kind of tossed it up and went on in. Reagan could do stuff like that with the TV cameras on and the public watching him. And that one in particular was a magnificent event of no consequence, but a moment that I remember very well, because it wasn't the Lakers, it was the 76ers, because I talked to Julius Erving there, and he had a little broom, this is how I remember, he had a little broom on his lapel, and I said, what are you wearing that broom for? And he said, The sweep. We swept the Lakers, and they'd beaten them four straight. Anyway, the fifth thing is that Reagan was and is a larger-than-life figure, and Bush is a smaller-than-life figure, actually. Now, when I say larger-than-life, as a reporter, the figure, I mean, this is a quality of force while in the first term, then he became Bush's vice presidential press secretary, and then he came back as Reagan's press secretary, claims that it didn't make any difference what Reagan said at all those press conferences. Remember the ones where he would bomb, at least all the reporters thought he would bomb, and they'd put out the scorecards where Reagan made 19 errors and so on after press conferences. Marlin finally concluded that, and he believes to this day that it didn't make any difference, that there was just such magic with Reagan's presence and his charisma and his star quality that he could say anything and the American people would like him. I think that carries the whole idea of charisma and to an extreme, but Marlin believes this entirely. He really does. And the other thing about Reagan that you have to have if you're going to be a larger-than-life figure, and there haven't been many in my reporting career, I think of Martin Luther King, George Wallace, Richard Nixon, while not a charismatic person, was certainly a larger-than-life figure and one of the most peculiar people I've ever met. But there has to be some mystery and some tension there. Well, there's not a whole lot of mystery with George Bush. There's not a whole lot of mystery with most political figures in this country. And there's no reason why there should be. But with Reagan, there was a mystery there. And the mystery was partly, or mainly even, how does this guy do it? You know, there was this tension there. You know, how much does this guy know? Does he really know what he's doing? I mean, is he just acting out some script that somebody has written for him. I think he wasn't, but there was always this tension there. You know, has he really got control of his job? I mean, is he really in charge here? And I've concluded that Reagan basically was, but there was always this tension there, and it's still around as far as Reagan's concerned. I had three or four private sessions with Reagan. The first one was in August, September of 1984, when they brought about four or five journalists in. Pat Buchanan was one. This was before he'd gone to work for Reagan. David Broder, myself, a couple others in to chat with Reagan one afternoon. And Reagan was amazingly uncommunicative. He didn't say anything. I remember Broder asked him about Mondale, you know, just an ambiguous question like, you know, what do you make of this guy Mondale? Reagan didn't say anything. This was not only off the record. I mean, this was not only, this was supposedly completely off the record. Of course, Reagan knew that nothing's ever really off the record if you're telling it to a journalist in Washington. And Reagan said practically nothing. I mean, I learned zilch from going to that thing. It was in the library downstairs in the White House. Then when Pat Buchanan got to the White House, he arranged lunches for journalists there, and I got to go to the second one. Novak went to the first one. The second one with Mort Kondracki, who was then at Newsweek, now is back at the New Republic, and Paul Harvey, the radio guy, who sounds exactly like he does on the radio. And here we were in this private, off-the-record lunch, and he was presenting himself as the spokesman for America, you know, in there to see the president. I thought we were there to lunch, have a lunch and chat, but Paul Harvey thought otherwise. I thought he was a jerk. But he's great on the radio. But in any case, I sat there with Reagan. I was sitting right next to him, and this is an hour and a half it went on, and the only question that he even got animated about in answering was one when I asked him something about movies, whether he'd seen any good movies lately or something. And Reagan has some amazing ideas about movies, but he started off by telling me a story about a movie in Hollywood, a story he's told many times, and I won't bother with it now. But it was exactly the same story I'd heard back in August or September of 84 when I'd asked him about movies in that session with the other reporters. But he did say, the one interesting thing that happened when I saw him in September 84, we were leaving, and I asked him if he'd seen the movie Red Dawn. Are you all familiar with the movie Red Dawn? Most of you probably aren't. I don't go to many movies. I try to go to movies. My wife gets mad at me when I say this. I try to go to movies that, from my standpoint, being pretty conservative, are politically correct. And that means I don't go to many movies. But in any case, Red Dawn is about a communist invasion of the United States where they seize a great chunk of the United States and in the middle of the country, and then some teenagers stage a rebellion that eventually thwarts it's not a very good movie, but kind of fun. And all the liberal critics naturally panned it. But in any case, Reagan, I asked him if he'd seen it, and he said, yeah, I saw that movie. He said, they got the plot entirely wrong. He said they should have redone the plot. He said it was crazy to have these guys just rebelling. They couldn't have done that. He said what they should have done is call for another army to come in, because we had an army on the West Coast, and they should have come in, and then the teenagers would get together with their army, and they'd hook up, and then they'd drive, and he went on. He had a whole other plot for the movie. Actually would have made a better movie. But that was the only interesting thing he said at that session. It's the only thing I remember at any rate, except he didn't say anything about Mondale. Bob Novak, the story about, I mean, how frustrating Bush can be for reporters. The most frustrated person I ever talked to about this was Bob Novak. And during, between 76 and 80, Reagan naturally went around and made a lot of speeches because he was thinking of running in 1980. He basically decided. And Novak was going to do a column on him, and so this is in 78, I think. And so he picks him up in Florida. And then Reagan had a private plane, a small private plane, that was going to fly all the way to Oklahoma that night. So it was going to take a long time in a small plane. And Novak thought, boy, I'm going to have about 3 hours sitting next to this guy. I'm going to pump him for everything I've wanted to know for years. This isn't going to be just one column. I'm going to get 10 columns out of this. He got no columns out of it, as it turned out. He said Reagan, the only thing Reagan would talk about where he would say anything was movies. That was all he would talk about. And he talked on and on about movies, you know, all the old Errol Flynn stories and stories about Robert Taylor and all these things. Reagan loved to talk about that stuff, but Novak got nothing out of him and was incredibly frustrated as a result. Well, what haven't I touched on here? That most of these questions are deal with people who served in the administration. I covered it. I didn't serve in it. And so I don't know what else to add. Why don't I, if anybody has any questions, why don't I try and answer them, or at least respond to them, if nothing else. Yes?
A lot of people who are in public life can make a tremendous public impression that you've been thinking about Reagan, and then they seem they will really turn themselves off, maybe to conservatives. I'm told that this Kilpatrick, that you probably know well, who writes for the Colin James Academy.
Yeah, and I've met him. I don't know him.
I'm told that he's privately, personally, he hasn't very much to offer. I've known
I don't know. I wouldn't know about
Bradley
that.
Bradley could be very, he wasn't much of a, he's not a good example. What, if I got a chance to look at him, what was Reagan like in private company?
I think Reagan. Yeah, I think Reagan was charming, but not interesting. Reagan was much more interesting in public than he was in private. I think he didn't have much to say. Didn't want to say much. It didn't want to talk about himself a lot. Didn't reveal much. Certainly never did to journalists, and I don't think he did to others either. It'd be a lot of small talk and not much more than that. Reagan was interesting on the public stage, but privately not so interesting in the meetings that in the interviews and so on that I had with him, and from talking to other people who dealt with him. That's the best I can answer, I guess.
Is that any different than other politicians who try to conceal themselves, who have strategic reasons for not showing them, or
well, most politicians are pretty talkative about themselves and reveal more than you want to know sometimes. I mean, you really don't feel with most of them that there's a wall there. I mean, if you're in journalism, usually they want to put their best face forward. They want you to like them. They want you to write favorably about them. They're charming and interesting in private. Usually, when you've seen a politician in public and you've covered him, you know, you've heard him give the same speech a number of times, and when you get with him in private, it's a lot more interesting. There's fresh material there. With Reagan, there's no fresh material. There's not, you've already got his best stuff, and there's, and it's not as interesting in private. He's not a guy I'd want to spend a lot of time with, except for the fact that he's a charming person. I mean, but I wouldn't want to particularly spend a lot of time with to talk about geostrategic affairs or something, or about the election of 1992 and who's going to run, who's going to win, and so on. I mean, Nixon, you could sit around and talk about that stuff for hours. Reagan, he wouldn't have much to say. It'd be pretty pedestrian. Yes,
Mr. Fernbach.
You referred to his second term as something of a downhill.
Yeah, well, it was.
With old age
setting in. Yeah, that was a part of it.
How about the impact of the Round Contract?
Well, that's another thing that obviously, I mean, you had several things that came along. You got old. The Democrats took over the Senate, and right on the heels of that, a day or two later, Iran-Contra broke. And that created a buzz in Washington and around the country that went on for so many months that Reagan couldn't ignore it. He couldn't just block it out. And that took a lot out of him. Dropped 20 points in the polls, and there's the famous story of what he said to Bob Dole. You know, Bob Dole said something about, you know, well, you still got all the, why don't you, something about fans, and Reagan said, well, you may have fans, I don't have any fans anymore. You know, he was really downtrodden. He was really down in the dumps. That was the only time I know of where Reagan was really down in the dumps in his entire presidency. This is the spring, late winter and spring, you know, Don Regan's getting fired and Nancy's manipulating everybody and or trying to. She denies a lot of it in her book, but I expected that. And Reagan was really really down in the dumps. He'd had surgery in January of 1987. I'm not sure which surgery that was, prostate surgery, colon something.
Was he a man to stick with old friends? I'm thinking of Meese, who's...
Meese was not a friend. Meese was an employee. Meese was a guy. He'd worked for him as governor of California. There was not a peer relationship with Ed Meese. Nancy didn't like Ed Meese. Says so in her book. Meese, while I think every cabinet member was invited to a private dinner, and his wife or husband was invited to a private dinner at the residential part of the White House, you know, the part that Sam Donaldson and Diane Sawyer walked around with the Bushes in, the second floor. Every cabinet member but Ed Meese and his wife Ursula, they were never invited up there. Private dinner with the Reagans. I mean, Terrell Bell and his wife were.
Did he have any affection or any political colleagues?
He had a lot of affection for them. But out of sight, out of mind. You know, they were gone, and he didn't. And he had great loyalty. But it was political loyalty; it wasn't personal loyalty. I mean, he stuck with Meese. Remember the entire period when Meese had been nominated for Attorney General, and there was a special prosecutor investigating him, and it went on for a year. And Reagan was under great pressure to jettison the nomination. He never flinched. I mean, it never occurred to him to really do it, to drop it. He was going to stick with Meese because that's what you did. I mean, that was political loyalty. That wasn't particularly personal loyalty, I don't think. Yes.
If they weren't personal friends, why was he reluctant to fire people that needed to?
Well, he was just reluctant to fire anybody. I mean, why was Jimmy Carter reluctant to fire people? Why doesn't George Bush fire people? It's hard to do, and presidents don't like to do it. Something odd happens in the White House. These guys can't fire anybody. I don't know why. They don't. While Reagan reveled in public political confrontation, he didn't like personal confrontation with anybody. And Bush doesn't either, for that matter.
Paul David.
I remember it during the first year of the administration, more or less, there were repeated stories about this gang of half a dozen Los Angeles millionaires who were supposed to be his top advisors on.
It was the kitchen cabinet.
Yeah, well, were they not friends?
Not really. These were the Justin Dart and Henry Jorgensen and Holmes Tuttle. They were friends, but not close friends. Basically, these were the people that back in the 60s, after Reagan's speech in 1964 for Goldwater, the famous speech, decided, aha, this is a hot political property, why don't we run him for governor? And they went, and that's when they got to know Reagan. That's when they went and grabbed Reagan and raised money and ran him for governor. And they became friends, but it was basically a political association. They weren't friends in the way that we normally think of friends, you know, somebody you may have known from college that you've stayed in touch with all these years and you talk to all the time and you confide in and you ask their advice and so on. About personal things, I don't think they were friends like that. And besides, the White House staff really shut them out in terms of having any influence. I mean, you can imagine how much Jim Baker or Ed Meese or Mike Deaver wanted these rich guys out in California shaping the policy of the Reagan administration. Then they made sure they weren't doing that, saw Reagan very little, and so far as I know, Reagan never said, gee, where are all my buddies from L.A.? Why aren't I talking to them? If he said it, I never heard of it.
They are the same gang that got together to buy him the house that he's in now.
Some of them are the same ones, yeah.
Victor, yeah.
I wonder if you'd like to comment on this situation. Mm-hmm. At the times President Reagan didn't seem to be aware of the linkage between cause and effect.
Like when?
Particularly the Versailles Economic Conference, where they laid out the broad outlines. Of course, it's always done before they get there.
Sure.
They agreed to certain things. And they'd hardly gotten back home when President Reagan clamped down on the French and others for wanting to go ahead and build the gas pipeline for the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And a great deal of unemployment.
Yeah.
And GE was involved, he threatened to defend the court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why would a man make such a diversion from cooperation to threaten to sue everybody?
Well, I really don't know. You know, here's my excuse for not knowing. The things I usually know about are the things I actually did reporting on. And I never wrote anything on the whole pipeline controversy. I didn't go to that particular economic summit. And frankly, I just don't remember it that well. So I don't have any personal knowledge of why Reagan did that. It might be he just didn't understand what it meant. I don't know. But see, that was the pipeline thing was a vestige of Reagan's longstanding anti-communism, and he just didn't think it was a good idea. And I mean, there's something Reagan would sometimes, he would say things, he would be forced sometimes to say things in public that he didn't really believe. For instance, Reagan said that, wait a minute, I'll think of it here, because he said the opposite to me in an interview when I interviewed him in October 87. And it has to do with Iran-Contra. And I'll think of it in a minute. But it was something he was forced to say publicly about Iran-Contra. And he didn't believe it at all.
That third countries hadn't been involved?
No, it wasn't that. He knew that third countries had been involved. I'll think of it in a minute. But that may be the case there. That there was something that, for policy reasons, he was forced to say it, and he didn't really believe it. And when somebody got to him later, he said what he really believed. That can make diplomacy awfully difficult.
Bill Wimple.
I have always wondered, since the first Iran-Contra publicity, why Reagan didn't get his team together right away, find out what happened, go on TV and tell the people, take the responsibility and say we were trying to get the hostages out, and we learned something that we probably should have known already, which was that if you try to deal with those Middle Eastern rug dealers, you're going to get out traded every time.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a simple...
Instead, he kept quiet and let the...
Well, he didn't entirely keep quiet. Here was the problem. The problem was that Oliver North, Bud McFarlane, well, Bud McFarlane was not on his staff, but yeah, I guess. Maybe he was, and Poindexter were all lying to Reagan and Bill Casey, where they were concocting a story about what went on that didn't happen. I mean, Reagan thought that was happening. They were getting the story together, and I mean, this is a part of his problem of over-delegation, which is something I didn't really touch on. But he thought that was going on. And remember the press conference he had, I believe, on November 19th of 1986, and the scandal had broken on about the 7th or something. And he went on, and the press conference is famous for the amount of untruths and misinformation that Reagan stated, because this is what he had gotten from Poindexter and Casey and so on. I think that's the problem. He had, and Reagan was so aloof from what was going on that he was victimized by these people on his staff. His own fault, but I don't mean to absolve him in any way, but I think that's the explanation. He didn't know what the truth was, and they told him something that wasn't true.
General Disney.
With respect to initiatives, did he rely heavily on staff and advisors to suggest to him what he should do, or did he direct them to get the information to support what he wanted to do?
Well, all the things I suggested were ones that I talked about were ones that were basically Reagan initiated. You think Jim Baker would have gone for a deep, controversial 3-year tax cut in 1981? He'd have compromised for a third of that. SDI... Baker never did like it. The zero option, deploying the Pershings and all those are all things that Reagan wanted to do. Grenada?
His initiative.
Grenada, Reagan wanted to do that. The Pentagon didn't want to do it. He had to order him to do it. Of course, the Pentagon doesn't want to fight anywhere but these days. And he had to order him to do it. So That's why I think when books come out like this one by Bob Schieffer and Gary Paul Gates, the acting president, and characterizing Reagan as a guy just completely aloof from what goes on, you can cite examples of that. Iran-Contra is one, and the problems Reagan got into. But on other things, on the most important things that went on in his administration, Reagan was the driving force and a strong ideological force behind these things. He instigated them. I mean, they didn't just come out of thin air. I mean, SDI didn't, but Reagan, it was all Reagan's doing to put that into speech and to embark on that initiative.
Louise?
What did you think about his relationship with his daughter, Patty, who wrote the book about her relationship with him?
Yeah.
Did this bother him very much? He was always talking about the importance of the American family life and all, and it was in such a contrast.
Yeah, well, Reagan had a real, has a very a very weird family, I've always thought. I think the book bothered Nancy a lot more, and she comments on it in her book, than it did Reagan, although he said he read it. I'm not sure whether he did or not. And I haven't read her book. Reagan, if you go back and read books, and I've tried to read all of them about Reagan's early life and his early married life and so on. Some of the books are terrible, but there is a certain amount of information in them. And there's one thing that comes through clearly, I think, in all of them, is that Reagan is basically a terrible parent. He's not a good father. He's a charismatic leader, but he just didn't spend much time with his kids. His adopted son, Michael, was a football star at a prep school in Arizona. Reagan never went to see him play. And so on like that. He handed the job of disciplining the children entirely to Nancy, who I think is kind of a brittle person, and you know, he should have done a lot of it himself. And you know, you need the father and the mother need to do that, I think. It's the way it works at my house anyway. It would have worked when I was growing up too. There's something missing there in Reagan's personality. He just, maybe it was from his own experience of his father.
Who was a drunk.
And Reagan didn't know what he needed to do and never came home, and you know, basically an absentee father.
He talked anyway. So much about the importance of family life and so forth.
Well, you could say there's a certain hypocrisy there. But they don't have a warm, chummy family life the way the Bushes do, for instance. I mean, Reagan will be remembered as a greater president, I'm certain, but Bush will be remembered as a greater father.
What do you think of the story that Reagan was traveling with Michael one time on a plane coming into Washington, and Reagan kept counting on his fingers, and Michael said, "Well, what are you doing?" And he said, "I'm counting one." He heard him say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And he said, "I'm counting. It's 10. In 10 months, I'll be able to go to church again." Does that suggest something that runs counter to the proposition that Bush practices his values and Reagan really didn't have much seriousness about values in that area?
You mean in religion?
Conventional religion.
Well, I've always been mystified about Reagan's religion. I was in the on the panel of the first Reagan-Mondale debate in 1984, and I asked a question. You have to, and if you remember the format for these debates, you ask a question of one candidate and a follow-up, and then ask roughly the same question to the other candidate in the follow-up. So I asked first Reagan about what, as a professed Christian, and remember, this is in October of 1984, and the whole question of religion and politics has been discussed the whole time, and Reagan's appeared at the various religious events, and Mondale has talked a lot about his father was a minister and all this. So religion had been in it, and I thought it was a perfectly legitimate question. And my question was to Reagan, do you consider yourself a born-again Christian, and in what way does your Christian faith has it affected your decision making in the White House? And he gave me some answer, and I forget, it was some empty answer, but you get a follow-up. And I've always sort of followed the theory that, I asked the question, it was a follow-up I was interested in. Ask a question that you're interested in knowing the answer to. And instead of, most of these questions at press conferences or what, or these stem winders about the deficit that nobody cares about the answer to. But so I asked him, why don't you go to church? You know, you're a Christian, why don't you go to church? And I thought I had an airtight question. Why don't you go to church? Or why don't you have a minister come into the White House the way Richard Nixon did? Or if you're at Camp David, have one come there the way Jimmy Carter did. Well, he gave this answer about, he didn't want to go to church because the church might get blown up or something. And an answer, if he'd given that answer really would have precluded his doing anything in public, ever giving a speech anywhere because there might be some terrorist attack. And Reagan didn't, he dodged the first question and he didn't have a real response to the second one. And I've never really understood Reagan's Christian faith. Reagan thinks that he is a deeply faithful Christian. Yet most Christians that I know, including myself, in the natural course of events, go to church most of the time. You want to. It's very natural. But Reagan doesn't seem to want to. Yet there are certain areas of Christianity that he has almost an obsessive desire to talk about, particularly the apocalypse, which is probably the area that I'm least interested in talking about. But Reagan is very interested in that. And he has talked at great length. He does have some Christian leaders, this guy, Reverend Mumaw from L.A., whose church he used to go to sometimes, has talked to him, and so have others. But to be honest, I just really don't know the state of Reagan's faith. I know what he thinks it is, but I'm not sure what it really is.
Other questions? What about Reagan's restraint of KAL and other things, along with this passive mm-hmm. person, active policy? Why, there have been cases, haven't there, where a true activist would have struck and where he showed great restraint?
Well, it was a Korean plane, after all. It wasn't an American plane. I'm not so sure that was that great a restraint. I don't know whether that would be a good test of Reagan's restraint, the KAL incident. And the whole thrust of Cy Hirsch's book is that, I don't know if it's correct or not, but he says that the White House and the Reagan administration exploited that affair and accused the Soviets of purposely shooting down a defenseless plane even after the White House knew that it was basically accidental that they shot it down. In other words, that they really did mistake it for an intruding spy plane. That's what Cy Hirsch says, anyway. I don't know.
Leaving aside content, what about his capacity to write when he was rewriting this speech? Edgar Shannon, former president of the University of Virginia.
Yeah, he was the president when I was here.
Right. Tells a story that they've reached an impasse in the Rockefeller Commission, and they couldn't get a statement the way they wanted it. And Reagan said, well, let me see what I can do. Mm-hmm. And he excused himself, went out of the room, came back and presented a recasting of the, mm-hmm. of the arrangement. And they said, well, this is exactly what we all
want. Reagan is a great editor. I've talked at great length to all the speech writers. I got to know some of them pretty well in Reagan's time. And Reagan, no president writes his own speeches. They just don't do it. And they start, and they don't even work up a first draft. They're presented with a speech by after some general ideas are tossed out. But Reagan could do some really magical editing to it, putting in personal vignettes, adding jokes, all the personal touches, all the Reagan things. Reagan would put in himself all the things that made his speeches good and memorable and things like, remember for a while Reagan had in his State of the Union speeches, he'd have some hero up in, sitting up in the balcony at the House of Representatives, and he had that Vietnamese boatwoman who was a cadet at West Point. That's the one I remember the best. and the guy who dove in the Potomac and picked out some people that got it saved, the guy from the Air Florida crash, and so on. That was Reagan doing that, putting that in his speech. And it was. He could turn a drab piece of copy into a dazzling speech that would really hold your interest, but not hold your interest because of the content of the policy, but hold your interest just because of the Reagan touches and the vignettes and the stories and the jokes and so on.
Bush tried it, but it backfired.
Oh, well, Bush can't do it. Bush is terrible on television. And he just has, he's not a performer at all. It's awful. And you know his little thing with the sack of crack, I guess that's what you're referring to. And he just needs to stay off television. He can't effectively address the nation. But Bush is the norm. Reagan is the exception. I mean, Jimmy Carter wasn't so great. Richard Nixon wasn't either. Gerald Ford wasn't. Lyndon Johnson. I mean, there are not many people who, politicians who have this ability to communicate on television the way Reagan was. And I guess Kennedy could. The interesting thing is that Reagan sells books. The books that nobody would buy a book about Gerald Ford or Jimmy Carter or Richard Nixon. There's a certain audience for Richard Nixon, basically an anti-Nixon audience for books about Nixon. But Reagan, being this dazzling figure, there's really interest in him, and books about him have sold, and of course books about Jack Kennedy and about the Kennedys still sell like crazy. But you can't give away books about Carter and Ford.
Colonel Foote.
What would you say is the strongest point visible to you in Mr. Bush? Strongest favorable point. What have we got to walk away with some courage about it?
Strongest favorable point. Well, he's not going to have, he's not going to commit many sins of commission.
Nobody's fool.
He's nobody's fool, but he's but he calls it prudent. I think he's the most ultra-cautious guy we've ever had, which in a time of peace and prosperity works just fine. If we have a recession, if we have some world crisis, what's going to happen when, this is a very plausible scenario, people are out in the streets in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania demanding freedom, and Gorbachev sends in the tanks. Or what happens going to happen if Gorbachev is overthrown? What's Bush going to do? I don't know. But you can get by with doing practically nothing while our economy's humming along and the Soviet and communism is collapsing around the world. It's a lot easier. There are worse things than being cautious. Bush is not my type. He's not much fun. I mean, Bush, the current political era that we're in now, this kinder, gentler era, which Bush is a symptom of, not a cause of, is pretty lousy for journalism. Great for America, but lousy for journalism.
Dull as hell.
Yeah, basically.
One last question. Do you fellows feel as intensely as you speak on McLaughlin?
No, it depends on the issue sometimes. The one issue that that got people the most, since I've been doing that show, that got people the most emotional was not Iran-Contra in general, but Oliver North in particular. And the period when Oliver North testified before the Iran-Contra committee, even more in particular. That was when there were probably the most hostile disagreements on the McLaughlin group when I've been on. But actually, you know, I've known all those people on there for many years, not John McLaughlin that well. But Mort Kondracki and I have been friends for at least 15 years, and now we work together at the New Republic. Jack Germond was my boss at the Washington Star and was the guy who first assigned me to cover the White House and write about politics. This was back in the mid-70s.
Good book on the election, or what did you review?
His book on the, I have read it, I've read all he and Jules Whitcover's books on the election, and it has some good stuff in it, but I really think it needed to be more analytical. I found I wasn't that interested in the Iowa caucuses anymore, to go back and read what happened in 1980 in the Iowa caucuses. I'm waiting for a good book on the election. I've read the Newsweek book, and I've read Germond and Whitcover's book. And there's one by a couple of people on the Boston Globe which dissects the Dukakis campaign and why it went limp, which I haven't read, which is supposed to be pretty good. Then there'll be some books by some of the actors involved. I don't think, and so far, I'm waiting for a good book on the campaign. It was a good, an interesting campaign, so there ought to be a good book on it. In 84, it was such a dull campaign, there was no way you were going to have a good book. 80 was another good campaign, and Jermaine Whitfeber had a very good book.
We're terribly grateful that we could have this session.
Well, I'm sorry I couldn't come a couple weeks ago, or was it last week? I forget.
Yes, last week. Well, now that you found where we are, we hope you'll come again.
Okay, I'm sure I will.
And there are copies of the 75th anniversary.
This is last week. This one is the one that came out today.